not by a pope, but by a family. Because the Pamphili pope didn't really care for Bernini that much, in a way, it was a good thing. And Herbert mentions this in his book, in that if the Pamphili pope was keeping Bernini super busy, he probably wouldn't have had time to take this private commission, and so we would have not had this absolutely wonderful masterpiece that we do. But we're going to go inside the church and take a look. Before we discuss the sculpture itself, we should know a little bit about Teresa of Jesus, often called Teresa of Avila. She had lived in the century preceding, 1515 to 1582. She is a discalced Carmelite nun. Now, when she began, she wasn't discalced. She was just a Carmelite. Does anyone know what discalced means? Yeah.
I mean, they don't wear shoes.
Right, they don't wear shoes. And I have a funny story. We, at my parish, we have a priest went on vacation, and one of the discalced fathers came to give Mass, and I kept trying to look and see if he was barefoot. But he wasn't. But he was wearing sandals. This didn't mean that these nuns had to run around barefoot. The reason they are called discalced is because they didn't wear these really lovely, expensive, soft Spanish shoes that the Carmelite, regular Carmelite nuns did wear. What happened when was Teresa became a nun is the convent that she went to had almost a class system of the nuns. There were nuns that came from wealthy families who would have very nice apartments in the convent, and then because their parents would provide a lot of money for them, and then they had poor nuns that would come in that would essentially be servants for the wealthy nuns. And Teresa felt like this was really not appropriate, certainly not according to the rule of St. Albert that the Carmelites were originally founded on. The Carmelites come from Mount Carmel in present-day Israel and were established when the Holy Land was Christian under the Crusaders. But when the Saladin came in and the Muslims took back over the area, eventually they had to leave Mount Carmel. And they spread out through Europe. One of the areas they went was Spain. But this was quite several hundred years later, and the order had become somewhat lax, according to St. Teresa. So she took a group of nuns and started her own little nunnery with a stricter rule. And one of the rules was that they weren't allowed to wear these really expensive shoes, which is why they started to be known as discalced. And then she and John of the Cross kind of came up with these new rules. They weren't new rules. They were the old rules, but enforcing the rules. And eventually they broke away from the Carmelites themselves. So in that sense, they're kind of like Capuchin brothers are really a branch that came out of the Franciscans that just wanted to return to a stricter rule. And you do know that cappuccino, is anyone drinking cappuccino? Is named after the Capuchin monks because they're called cappuccini in Italy because they have these little brown hoods like the foam on top of the coffee. Okay, so I have all kinds of errata here. Okay, so Saint Teresa did write during her time, and she wrote sometimes to her nuns about how they should pray. And also, she ended up writing a life, but it was really based on her confessions. But at the time, the church was very concerned because we had the Protestant Reformation going on, and so they did not allow her life to be published during her lifetime. It wasn't published until after her lifetime. But she was very quickly canonized in 1622, and then later made into a doctor of the church, the first female to be declared a doctor. So we have various paintings here by different artists, kind of giving us an idea. This is probably closer to what she looked like. And then we have Bernini's rendition. Now, Bernini is showing us a moment from her life called the Transverberation. And he set this sculpture. He really designed the entire chapel here. It's called the Cornaro Chapel. That's the family that commissioned it. It's in Santa Maria della Victoria. And he designed this whole chapel area here for the family. The Cornaro family are actually, there's portraits here of them on each side, at least the men from the family, and then the women, although there weren't that many women because they were mostly ecclesial members, but they had to have mothers and sisters, so I don't know where they are, but they're not in the picture. The design includes architecture, where you have this elaborate, almost a temple form here, and the triangular pediment has actually broken open, and this is also part of the Baroque. That's why it's called Baroque, because it's broken, right? But it's almost as if it has so much energy springing forth, it actually broke the pediment open. And you have light streaming in here from, there's actually a secret stained glass window behind, that illuminates the sculpture. Now remember, there's no electricity yet in the 17th century, so churches, for the most part, were actually fairly dark. I mean, you'd have candle light. So this was kind of an extraordinary theatrical way that he made it look as if a light was descending upon St. Teresa. And then he has incorporated all these different colored marbles from various areas of Italy to create really what is almost like a tableau or a stage in which we are viewing this ecstatic moment from the saint's life. Her transverberation, as she describes in her autobiography, was one of the mystical experiences that she had. She had numerous ones throughout her life. This was one in which she felt an angel come to her that had a flaming sword that he used and pierced her heart, actually, several times. And she felt this incredible flame. It was painful, but it was also at the same time sweetly loving. And she felt the love of God. And so what Bernini had to do is somehow, in this physical means, in marble, which is what he chose, try to express a very spiritual experience, an experience really that was something that was almost out of her body, a type of experience, and yet she does use sensual words to explain how she felt. I told you that her life wasn't published until after her death, but very shortly it was published in many different languages, for Spanish. And so it was published in Italian, and we know that Bernini did read it. So he was working directly from her text. All right, so how does he portray this interior, very spiritual, almost ineffable experience, this ecstasy? And so we have this woman who's leaning back, seeming to have her eyelids roll back, her mouth kind of fall open, something that is often almost described as almost a sexual ecstasy look on her face. But he wasn't trying to portray this as sexual. It was sensual in the fact that she felt this love piercing her interior. But at the same time, it was also painful. And Teresa often describes how she lost all sensation of her body. She no longer felt her body during these mystical experiences. So it is interesting that, again, Bernini has read her entire vita. And so, though he is an artist who's perfectly capable of showing bodies under fabric, right, showing musculature under fabric, you don't really see much of a body under here. It's as if it's almost empty or vacant with all this undulating fabric all around. And that is to portray this sense where she no longer really is in her body. She's no longer feeling her body. What we do see of the flesh that we do see of her hand, her face, her hands, and her toes, they're almost limp, but at the same time you could see that they're almost tingling, like there's this energy coming out of them. I have a close-up a little bit here. As if there's a tautness in her toes, as if she was still, even though she is out of body, she's still also feeling this experience through some sort of sensation, which she does describe. And Professor Maddox was actually talking about, we were talking about texture in the marble, and you can do different things with marble if you buff it and shine it up, or if you leave it rough. This is actually, I think, travertine here, but you can do different things to create these different textures to convey to your audience something different. So these are supposed to be clouds that she's on. So it's almost as if she is levitating and being lifted up through this experience, because it is an experience that is happening in another realm, the heavenly realm. This is a plan, like we're looking down at the chapel. So the sculpture is actually right in here. Here's the opening with the two columns. And you have the altar down below. And then on each side we have these relief sculptures. So he designed the entire chapel. On the side, these gallery views, you can see there, just barely see these heads of people looking out. These are the members of the Coronado family. Now, often art historians will describe this as a theatrical production. It's very much as if what is occurring here is on a stage, and you have people almost in their balcony box seats watching what's going on. And certainly you can get that sense immediately, but when you take a little closer look, what are these people doing? We'll see that it's not exactly like theater. All right. This is where I've just taken the left side and the right side, and I've put them together so that we can look at it. These are portraits of the family, and they're probably fairly accurate because they would have paintings done of their family members. So we have each of these a different member. The only one who actually was not a member of the church is this little guy right here. He was a doge, Giovanni Coronado. They were a family from Venice. So these are people who are not necessarily all living right now. They're like, some of them are famous people that have already died from their family. Now, the person who commissioned and paid for this chapel is a Federico Coronado, and this is him right here. And this, according to Bernini's son, is the only sculpture here of these portrait sculptures that Bernini himself carved. He carved Teresa and the angel, but these were left up to some of his workers. Now, I want to point out to you that we have these are relief sculptures. They're attached to the wall. They're in very high relief. You can see them casting shadows here and actually turning and talking to each other. But then behind them, the relief is much shallower. He's giving the illusion of an architectural space that's going back into space. We have Ionic capitals, coffered, round vaulted ceilings, and even looks like a triangular broken pediment up there. And this is, if you recall, the Donatello leaf that we looked at of St. Lawrence. Donatello had already mastered this in the Renaissance. But he's using already known elements to create this illusion of space. And let's go look here. So when we look at these faces, you must recall that not all of them are necessarily by Bernini, but that doesn't mean that he didn't kind of draw them out and design them and have his students or his workers do it. This one is supposed to be by Bernini. That's nice. You can see with the lighting, see it a little better. Sometimes sculpture's actually better to look at in black and white photos, though. All right. Domenico Bernini's son, again, expressed that it was really only the group with Teresa and the angel and that one other that was by Bernini. So if Bernini is in charge of this commission and he chooses certain things to do himself and certain things to give other people. It certainly would show something about him personally, what he felt was of most interest to him. Certainly, this is the central figure. It's the most important figure. And typically, the master of a workshop would do the most important figure. But he was already assigning lots of other things, like the four rivers, and they were all major figures. But this he wanted to do himself. And so it kind of brings up some questions about him personally, his biography. We know that Bernini had a lot of children. His wife lived a fairly long time. They stayed married. Of course, they were Catholic, so they didn't divorce. He may have had a mistress at some point. There is a bust portrait of a woman that was actually the wife of one of his workers that it is suspected he might have had an affair with, but we don't know for sure. There's also a fair amount, certainly that came from his son, that said he was quite religious. And so he personally might have been quite interested in St. Teresa's writings himself. Certainly he was very interested in this challenge of how to show this spiritual, mystical experience and bring it to life in marble. I explained to you that there's a kind of hidden stained glass window here. You can see the view of the window, which normally you can't see unless you actually go inside the chapel, kind of up to the altar and peek in. So we have wood rods that are covered with gold. So it's a mixed media, lots of different marbles, travertine, and polished marble here. And the point of the light, of course, is to show that this is from God. Light often represents God, not only in Bernini's sculptures, but in paintings. And, of course, Christ said, "I am the light." But what Bernini also does is work with lights and darks, chiaroscuro. And I mentioned before that Caravaggio was a great master of this, and so was Bernini. Even though he wasn't a painter, he was a sculptor. But he knew how to create drama, additional drama, by areas of darkness and areas of light, where things would recede, where they would come forward. And that's certainly part of the genius of this particular sculpture. So I would ask you to think yourself and maybe make up your own opinion about this work. Certain scholars, again, describe it almost as theater, or that these viewers are watching some kind of inspiring narrative and discussing it. Or is it simply spiritual voyeurism, where these figures on the side are kind of getting a glimpse into something maybe they never have experienced or will experience? So there's actually a more questions asked about this than are really answered. But most people feel very drawn to it. I've heard a few people that it bothers. They don't like it. But most people find it exquisite. Okay. Fortunately for Bernini, we have a new pope. And this is Alexander VII. He is a Chigi from the Chigi family. And I wrote that he's like the Barberini in that he really brings back a lot of what Urban VIII had done. It kind of wipes away Innocent X's revisions and reverses these policies and brings back a lot of the policies of Urban VIII. And part of what he really wanted to do was go back and start building again and working on projects in St. Peter's. He was favored by Spain to actually get the papacy, and so he helped Spain a lot. He also helped the Jesuits. At one point, the Republic of Venice needed some help defending themselves from the Turks, and he said, "Well, I will if you let the Jesuits back in." They were kind of getting into trouble in some places and being expelled. He came in really as a reformer over nepotism, just retiring your own family. Oh, sometimes worked great. Charles Borromeo was the nephew of Pius IV, and he was one of probably the greatest people working in the Vatican ever for what he did. Rewrote the Catechism, oversaw the Council of Trent, the Third Council. But So he began not even allowing his family to come to Rome. But in the end, he ended up hiring family members and raising them up. So this is a portrait by Boccaccio, an artist of the Baroque period. Okay, what Alexander VII hired Bernini to do is to create the Cathedra Petri, or St. Peter's Chair, which is at the apse, the very back of St. Peter's, actually between these two tombs that we had seen before, Paul III, and here's Urban VIII. There were already some windows there, but he figured out how to incorporate this stained glass window. Now, what St. Peter's Chair is an actual chair. And it's a chair that, by tradition, was one that St. Peter himself would sit in when he would be talking to his fellow Christians and preaching and telling them stories about his experience with Christ. So it was a very important relic from the apostolic age, reported to have been from the apostolic age. And, of course, there's a great symbolism attached to it. If you think about cathedrals being, cathedra means chair, that's why they're called cathedrals. A cathedral is the place where the bishop's chair is. And so what do we have here in St. Peter's but where the Pope's chair is, which, of course, was originally Peter's and then is passed down to each subsequent pope. So this is where their chair resides. They don't actually go up and sit in there. Now, the wooden chair, it's actually had wooden ivory, the relic that they had, is encased within this bronze chair, not surrounded. I think they can pull it out from the back, and it's still in there. I don't know what kind of shape it could possibly be in by now. But there is an actual chair inside there. So we're going to look. This is another multimedia sculpture where we have bronze, wood, stucco, stained glass, and various different types of marble. So we have a wooden chair. I haven't actually seen it, but it's inlaid with ivory. It was commissioned by Alexander VII, and it was put on the altar in 1666. Now, the bronze cast chair that Bernini made has three scenes here on the back of it. We really can't see the details that well, but I'll tell you what they are. One is the moment when Peter is told by Christ to feed my sheep. And if you know your scripture, this after the resurrection, and Peter is Christ is asking Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yes, I love you. Do you love me? Which, by the way, we don't get in English because he's actually saying, do you love me, agape? And Peter is responding, I love you, filio. Well, agape is the type of love that is a self-sacrificial love. Filio is a brotherly love. So, see, Peter kind of kept messing up. He kept saying, I love you like a brother. And he's like, no, you don't get it. You need to love me unconditionally. But Peter did get it because he, of course, eventually was crucified upside down like his master. And at the end of that dialogue, Christ says, feed my sheep. So that scene is on here. Then we have the consignment of the keys to Peter, the keys to the kingdom. And then we have the washing of the feet, which actually happened before the Last Supper, which, of course, is when Christ tells his apostles that they need to serve. Just as he is serving them. And these are really almost like a Trinitarian prescription for what the Pope is supposed to do. He is supposed to take care of the flock. He, of course, is a ruler over the church on earth, making decisions about what is part of the magisterial teachings and what is not. And he is ultimately there to serve. And then we have at the top of the chair are two little putties holding up the papal tiara. All right, so we know about the chair, we know about the putties and what's on the chair. We're going to discuss now these figures and then this area, which is called the Gloria. Okay, these figures that hold up the chair are four of doctors from the church. They're early fathers that were made into doctors. We have the two on the outside that come from the Latin church, the Church of the West, and then the two on the inside are from the Eastern Church. So we have St. Ambrose and St. Augustine from the Latin Church, and we have St. Athenaeus and St. John Chrysostom. Thank you. And the two Latin fathers are wearing the hats, and the other two are not. Now, this device, the way he has this, it looks as if they are not even holding up the chair. It is more as if they are tethering it down. You know, like you're having to hold a balloon, a hot air balloon that just keeps wanting to rise up. And, of course, it's not. It's made out of bronze, so it weighs a ton. But this is all part of Bernini's illusion. But there is a symbolic meaning to this in that these are mediators between the heavenly realm up here and the earthly realm. They are those who are interpreting doctrine, interpreting scripture for us, and really kind of help keep the world connected to the heavenly realm. Okay, now the Gloria is, of course, the central area is the Holy Spirit, the dove in the center with the stained glass window. And the way he achieves this sense of light kind of pouring out is the stained glass at the very center is thinner and gets thicker here. So you get more light coming through, lighter light coming through. It is ultimately divided into 12 sections representative of the 12 apostles. And then we have a beatific vision, just streaming out, light pouring out, angels of many different orders, seraphim, cherubim, lots of putti, and then these, of course he uses these rods, these wooden rods that are covered with gold. There's your dove right there. And how many of you have seen this? It's extraordinary, isn't it? It's the first time I saw it, I was just overwhelmed. I thought it was... I think him really being able to express as best he could what a beatific vision would look like. Now, you have some pretty odd views if you can come around to the side, each side, and kind of gaze up at these angels up in the Gloria. Their interaction, they're talking to each other. And this is where you get those really high lighted areas and darkened areas, the chiaroscuro. And you get this sense of upliftment when you're looking at it. You have to look up. Your head is looking back. And so it almost helps transport you up as you look up at its majesty. Here we have some close-ups of the fathers here. Again, almost like the angels on top of the baldacchino, how, you know, they're just holding it up with these little vines. They're holding up or holding down the chair of St. Peter. All right, just so we know where this is, right here in the apse. And if you think of a church that has any church, St. Peter's is called a basilica, by the way, it's not a cathedral. Because though the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, his bishop's chair is in St. John Lateran, not at St. Peter's. So it's not called a cathedral, it's a basilica. The most important altar in a church that has a crypt with a martyr, and this is true in any of the churches, is the altar right over the crypt. So this is the central altar, the most important one. But really secondary is typically in the apse. Now, what's interesting is Charles Borromeo, the century before, who was doing a lot of reform, I told you he rewrote the catechism and kind of oversaw the Third Council of Trent. He actually wrote directions about how churches should be set up. And one of the things he said is that the apse should be in the east, so that the holiest areas of the church are facing towards Jerusalem. Which way is this facing? Where's the light coming from? The west, exactly. It's completely opposite. Here in the United States, they don't pay much attention to that, which way the churches are. But if you go to France, you'll know Notre Dame, Chartres, all the great cathedrals are in France. The medieval Gothic cathedrals all have their apse in the east. St. Peter's does not have its apse in the east because it had to have this orientation because of the way the tomb was set up and then how it faced out towards the city, towards the Tiber. And this gave this wonderful western window for Bernini to work with on the cathedra. Okay, we're going to actually continue outside of St. Peter's, back out just for a little brief look at one of his side jobs. This is not a papal commission. And it's a foray into architecture, where he designed a little church, San Andrea al Quirinale. This was for a Jesuit seminary. And it's very interesting. He was able to be a lot more experimental. When you're doing things for the Pope, you kind of have to work within a little more traditional lines. And this is a small church, so he was able to really be more experimental, and it's shaped like an oval. And if you think about the Pantheon being there, a lot of architects are drawn to this shape when they're in Rome. In fact, the first plans for St. Peter's is that it was going to be an even equal-sided cross shape, but they ended up expanding out the nave to a Latin cross. We're going to go inside and look real quick here. This is the main altar. Of course, St. Andrew, whose head was in St. Peter's, the brother of Peter, that's who this is dedicated to. And look how there's a painting here. He died. He was also crucified, but on a X-shaped cross. So he's down here being crucified. And then we have light. And guess what? His whole soul has just burst through, broken open the pediment that isn't even triangular now, it's like semicircle, broken it open and is ascending, his soul ascending up into heaven. So Bernini's really getting to kind of play around with this idea. And then here you can see the oval dome and the lantern of the church. Did any of you get to go see this when you were in Rome? Did you go on a tour with the school? Or?
I worked at the school, yeah.
Okay.
The teacher took them to
Okay, the great, good, I'm glad to hear go there. All right. We're back at St. Peter's, and we're going to take a look at this staircase. Just briefly, there's something I think that's very important about it. It's actually a staircase that turns and go up, and it connects St. Peter's to the papal apartments. And our viewpoint looking up this stairs, this sculpture right here is right here. So this is a sideways view. This is, of course, papal commission, and the equestrian statue, and just think, historically, equestrian statues are pretty important. It's one thing that Bernini hasn't gotten to do yet, so he finally got an equestrian statue commission, and this is certainly an important one, because that is the Emperor Constantine, of course, who legalized Christianity, himself converted on his deathbed, and his mother was St. Helen, the one that went to Jerusalem and got picked up the cross and other elements. Now, we have not only the beauty of the horse and the musculature of the horse, but also this sense of movement that Bernini has shown us over and over again his capabilities of doing. This is the moment when, as the story goes, Constantine, not yet emperor yet, there's actually a fight after you have four emperors, and one of them retires, Diocletian. And so there is a battle over who's going to be the emperor. Maxentius has taken over Rome and is declaring himself emperor, and Constantine comes in with his troops. But he has a vision in which he is shown a cross in the sky, and is told, by this sign, you shall be victorious. And so we actually have the Cairo. By the way, it was actually a cross like this. The Cairo, which is the symbol for the Roman Catholic Church, comes from this sign. So here's a little more in color, you can see. And even this drapery, it's all marble. It's all marble. Now, fortunately, he does have this backdrop here, because how else could you create a marble horse standing on its two back legs like that? That would be pretty difficult. Maybe in bronze, but certainly in marble. But of course, he has it affixed to the wall. Now, in 1665, Bernini had a very special invitation from King Louis XIV to come to France. Louis XIV was remodeling, adding on to the Louvre, which was the French palace right in Paris, and had heard so much about Bernini that he invited him there to come and discuss what type of architecture he thinks would be appropriate. Bernini is pretty advanced here in age, but he goes ahead and does it. And remember, of course, you don't have trains, you don't have cars, so he had to go by a coach led by horses. So he goes up to Paris and confers with all the French architects and the king, and goes to the court and actually makes this bust portraiture of Louis XIV. He actually doesn't think very highly of the French, and they ultimately do not appreciate his genius because they don't use his designs. But it was still an extraordinary trip and a moment when he at least got to go out of the country. All right. Of course, Alexander VII wanted Bernini to design his tomb. And this one has some similarities to Urban VIII. We have the Pope here seated. Now, here he's praying. And so it's interesting because Urban VIII was a Pope who really had great command. He's kind of like Julius II. He wasn't so much a soldier, but certainly he was controlling a vast papal states. He was rebuilding Rome. And here Alexander VII has been shown much more of someone who's kind of humble and prayerful. So this may give some insights into their personalities. Now, most of this was executed by assistants, Bernini's assistants, but the entire plan was his. This time we have at the Pope's feet four virtues. We have charity, truth, justice, and prudence. But when the tomb was almost done, the Pope decided that truth that Bernini had made nude, and this question was coming up earlier, should really not be on a papal tomb. So he had him bring some marble and cover her up. And charity also had bare breasts that kind of had to be covered up a little bit too. So here you have the covering. And of course, this happened to Michelangelo, though it was by a different pope on the Sistine Chapel wall of the Last Judgment. So here we have a very content, happy baby sleeping there in charity's arms, and truth, with the light of truth coming forward, but she's having to cover herself up. A lot of times, yes, the truth is, Michelangelo was really an artist that pushed for nudity in art as being representative of truth, kind of the soul, revealing the soul of the person through the nude form. And, of course, he had been part of Ficino's Neoplatonic group under Lorenzo de' Medici, so he kind of had this idea of the forms and the truth being something pure, something elevated above the physical. And so when he would show nudity, it wasn't kind of a coarse erotic nudity as so much as something trying to depict something spiritual. And I'm sure that's what Bernini was going for here, but they didn't want to do that. So also, we have death here, just like we had with Urban VIII. This skeleton, this death, though, is hiding his face, almost as if he doesn't want to reveal himself. And yet he holds an hourglass because, of course, this is being built during the lifetime of the Pope, so it's kind of like holding off, don't die. But eventually he is mortal and will die, as all humans do. Okay, we are now going to journey to this chapel here. This is for the next pope, commissioned for the next pope, Clement X. And it's an entire chapel just dedicated to the Holy Sacrament. It has a tabernacle in it to hold the host after they've been consecrated, where they can be kept. And they can also do a Eucharistic adoration in this chapel. He did design the whole chapel, but Bernini took special attention to the design of the tabernacle, which I hear from the side and hear from the front. And this is getting fairly late in his career. It's in the 70s, and he died in 1680. And so possibly a more even intensely religious focus in his later years. It certainly happened to Michelangelo. The way he has designed this tabernacle is it looks very much like Bramante's Tempietto, which is a temple in Rome, a small little temple that really looks back to classical Roman temples and even Greek temples. They had some round temples. So you say, why would you have a pagan style architectural design like that? Well, that is because they didn't know, but they thought that the original temple in Jerusalem, the one by Solomon, was actually round. They just kind of assumed that it was, which is why, say, in Raphael's painting and Perugino's painting of the Marriage of the Virgin, where you have Joseph and Mary being espoused, the Virgin Mary being espoused, the temple of Jerusalem that's in the background is round and looks like this type of temple. So he's certainly referencing the temple in Jerusalem, which, of course, was where the Ark of the Covenant was held. And then he's referencing the Ark itself, because when God gave the description of how to build the Ark, in the Old Testament, there were angels on it. So he's referencing the Ark. And what was held in the Ark but God, right? We have the Ten Commandments, the Rod of Aaron, and God himself traveled with the Israelites as they moved around in the Holy Land. And that, of course, is what the tabernacle is, too. It holds God. So there's a reason it's referencing all these Old Testament places of where God was housed. All right. Also for this same pope, Clement the Ninth. Oh, wait. Yes. We have... Is this a new pope? Got enough. The 10th. Did I get my numbers off? Yes. This should be Clement the Ninth. Okay. This is the Raspigliosi. This pope commissioned Bernini. I'm going to have to look back and see if I've messed up our numbers here. This pope commissioned Bernini to design this bridge. Now, there was already a bridge there, but he revamped it. And this is the bridge that goes over to Castelangelo. The place where the popes would kind of hide out since medieval times if they were under siege in the city. And what he designed, he didn't really make these sculptures. He was a little old by this time. But what he designed is all these angels that along the bridge, pont is the bridge, and each of them hold one of the implements or instruments from the crucifixion, such as the crown of thorns, the nails, the spear. I think we have the spear here. They're quite large. They're not as large as Longinus, but they're very large, and they're still out there. Okay, and we're going to end here with really one of Bernini's last commissions. It is a private commission, but it's for a cardinal who is related to Pope Clement. And it is called the Altieri Chapel. And he designed the whole chapel here, hired the artist to paint the painting. And it's the death of Blessed Ludovica Albertoni, who was actually a relative of the cardinal related to him. The painting back here is by Baciccio, who we met before as a painting the Pope. This is, her tomb is actually under here. Here's the sarcophagus. And then above it, we have the Blessed Ludovica herself. I'm going to go in closely here. And she looks as if, this comes from the very end of her life, where she received, at the very end of her life, a beatific vision. And so it's similar in some ways to the ecstasy of St. Teresa, but this is not something that regularly happened to her. She was much more of a quiet nun, not one that was really well known. She didn't write much, and certainly never became a doctor of the church. In fact, she was only blessed, not canonized. But here she is right at her death. You do have a sense of the body as opposed to a St. Teresa, so we see there is a bodily form here. But she's clutching her breast in this moment of transition as she leaves the body. This, by the way, this cloth is marble, not cloth. All of this, the pillow, is all marble. And here, you have to kind of get at this angle to see it, but you can kind of get a vision of what she is seeing. We have a cherub head kind of peering down from her as the veil lifts and she's able to see into heaven. And here you can see her hand. Her face has a similar expression, I think, to St. Teresa. But this whole composition is much more quiet, more serene, more restful, and I think also more final. And if we think of this as being done really close to the end of Bernini's life, we can understand that he possibly is a calmer person, a quieter person, not wanting to show so much activity as he did earlier, but still the fingers, the hands. He died 9 days before his 82nd birthday in 1680, and we have Pope Innocent the 11th was Pope at this time. So I think I did mix that other one up with the 9th. I think that was the 10th. And that is the end of my lecture. So I guess I talked too fast earlier because we've got some extra time. I'm going to go back so you can look at the popes and get it right since I messed that up for you. And then I'll take some questions too. Whoops, no, I want you back up here. Some questions, and then I'll have this open so we can go back to anything that you're interested in seeing again. Okay. By the way, this sculpture, I didn't have a picture to show you, but there was an ancient Roman sculpture, it was probably a copy of a Greek, that was found in Rome, and it was in really bad shape. So when Bernini was very young, they gave it to him, his father gave it to him to practice on. And so he actually carved on an antique sculpture. And that was right about just before he did this one. So he actually had some actual physical contact with ancient sculpture. Okay. It's kind of nice, get a review. And most of these I have up on, I don't think I have that particular one. I have that one on the far left, are up on Blackboard, so you can go over them. And baldacchino, I know in English we would say baldacchino, but in Italian, C-H-I, we have two C's even, is a hard sound key. And to remember that, think of spaghetti, even though it's G, it's G-H, spaghetti. It's the same thing. It's a hard I. If it's just C-I, then it's chi. So it's a baldacchino. Canopy. Okay. And there was something here I should mention, too. So how many of you, when you've been to St. Peter's, went down in the crypt? So you could see St. Peter's tomb. And last time I was there was John Paul II's tomb. A lot of times, they switch around, different times I've been there, switch around, but a lot of times where you come, you go in on the side, is that where you did kind of come in on the side? Outside, right. And then when you come out, you're inside St. Peter's, right? It's like all of a sudden you're inside St. Peter's. Well, where you come out is actually the staircase is here by St. Andrew. You actually come out of this pier, not out of here. And I did put, let me go back, this is also up, but I don't have what is at each number, so I'm going to have to kind of remember there, that one. Just want to find my popes so we get our popes right. All right, here we go. Here we go. Clement the 9th, then we have Clement the 10th, and then Innocent the 11th. So you have that correctly. So it is the 9th, it is the was the deal. Okay, and then it was under Clement the 10th, though he did not commission it. It was a member of his family that commissioned Blessed Ludovica. Sometimes I get typos in there. Okay, does anyone have any questions? I'm kind of in the middle, so I can go forward or backwards if you have anything. Probably everyone's tired and has to work in the morning. Any questions? Yes.
Where did they bury me?
Where did they bury Bernini?
And how did they commemorate it?
Oh, I should know that. Do you know that? Do you remember that?
Right now.
Yes, go ahead.
It's in St. Mary Major.
That's right. That's right. I remember reading.
It's a flat. Slab of marble with, you know, Bernini.
Bernini. And I'm trying to think. So when you go into St. Mary Maggiore, to the right?
It's on the right.
Right.
Okay.
I think I have seen that before. But it's nothing. It's nothing terribly extraordinary. Right. I mean, even like Michelangelo's, Vasari did Michelangelo's, it's not that exciting. I mean, no one could quite do what they did, right? But good question. So it's in Rome, it's nothing but.
Was there ever a poet during this time that just wanted to go low key? It's like, everything's been too outlandish, we've been spending way too much money on this, maybe we can tone
well,
it down.
Well, actually, the Pamphili Pope, which he didn't really do too much with Bernini, he was trying to tone down the spending. But he also had to finish, I mean, you have to finish St. Peter's. That's why you kind of put him in charge of the nave. As far as was he really low-key? Well, he did, what a lot of the popes did when they became pope, and it's why their families were always very excited when they became pope, is they kind of redid their palaces, their family palaces. Each of them usually had a very fine dwelling in Rome. And so he did actually fix, that's where the Four Rivers one is right in front of his house. So they did actually fix that up. But they had a fair amount of money of their own. I would assume since he was accusing the previous pope of using papal funds for personal gain that maybe he didn't use his own funds. But I can't contest to that. Typically one regime doesn't really change much from the one before. But, these weren't terribly bad popes, though. I mean, we've had a couple that were not so good. But and being an art historian, I can't help but be glad that they spent all this money on art. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Martin Luther's complaint about the indulgences, right? Well, those indulgences helped pay for St. Peter's. They did. So I can't be too upset about it. There was a question here. Yeah.
Was it at all strange that his sculptures are so, like, they have so much expression, so much movement, especially, if you do compare it to maybe ancient Greek sculptures where they're sort of serene and calm and at rest? Was there any sense of wondering how okay this was when we're talking about
Jerry, that? Excellent question, Holly. Yes. Now, the Renaissance, of course, is the rebirth of classical antiquity, and we're looking at the Baroque. Now, they didn't call themselves Baroque. They thought they were really still doing what the people in the Renaissance were. They were just kind of pushing the envelope, taking it further. But all that emotion and kind of extravagance, not everyone liked it. In fact, some people still today say they don't care for Baroque churches. One person in particular who didn't really care for this is a later art historian, we've heard of Vasari, and then we have a great art historian called Bellori, who actually was living a little later than this time, but writing about these artists. And his one little life in his lives on modern architects, artists, and sculptors is up on Blackboard. He wrote about, I can't remember what you went out of my mind. Poussin.
Yeah.
Right. When he was choosing, now, Vasari had already done like all the Renaissance artists. So modern, it's actually, the title is Modern Artists. So he wanted to take artists kind of from his own time and write about them. And but he had an idea of what art should be. And that's why I gave you a little section to read on the idea. And his idea was very classical in that you want to take these pure forms, these pure ideals, this perfect aesthetic, and get this idea and then bring it into the material world. And that idea was not something that was overly emotional or sensual. It had more of a classical order to it. Interestingly, in Bolori's biographies of all these artists, he didn't write about Bernini at all. Bernini's not in it. He didn't like Bernini. He didn't like his work. He put Caravaggio in it, but begrudgingly, almost to show this is not a good artist. But he kind of felt like he had to. And he said he wasn't a good artist because he looked too much at nature. Of course, Caravaggio, if you haven't had exposure to him, you'd see the dirt under the fingernails of people, and including the Virgin Mary. So he felt like he was too just natural. And what you want to take is the best, say, from, if you wanted to paint or sculpt a beautiful woman, you would take, oh, well, this woman has lovely arms, this one has lovely hair, this one has this, and you put it all together to create a perfect ideal. If you took it nature's never perfect. That was the concept. So, the Baroque kind of spectacle was not really appreciated by everyone, and that's why you end up having this movement, which we're going to be working towards, which is called classicism. And it's really happening about the same time. Or slightly later, but about the same time. And it's a movement back towards classicism, which eventually results in the neoclassical, even. Because you have a complete reaction from the Rococo, which comes after Baroque. So, good question. Anything else? Okay. I hate to excuse your students early for you, but...
That's okay. Well, I had a question. Bernini did theater as well as
he
a sideline.
He did design some stage sets. Yes, that is true.
And anything you might tell us about that, or do you know his plays? I think you know.
No, I don't. I don't. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But I know that he did, just like Boucher. Boucher didn't write plays, but he did theatrical sets. But see, those kind of things are ephemeral, so they don't really last. And as an art historian, we deal with more of the material cultural things that still exist.
Yes, although one book I was reading was talking about the funeral monuments they would do, not like these, but the temporary ones they would do.
Mm-hmm.
And those are apparently the big guys worked on those too.
Right, that's right. And then they'd have processions and bring them in. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Good question, but no, I don't know anything about plays that he wrote. But I know he was involved in theatrical productions. So he wrote plays?
I think he did at least one.
Oh, okay.
But it may not have been very good.
I don't know. I don't know. I've never heard of it, but that's one thing I found is that knowledge is endless. Endless. I'm always learning new things. So, okay, I'm going to let you excuse your class. I don't want to let you.
Well, yeah, so.
Because you might have a few things to say.
No, I think that's fine. We're okay. So, thank you all, and good night.
And I'll see you in April, I think.
Something
right?
Like that.
Okay.
It's up there somewhere.
Okay.
I'll get you.
For which one?
Thank you, Corey.
Yeah. Can someone turn the lights up for us right here?
Stop. How do I get you to stop?